Dispatch Corporation, 11-2374. Mr. Nathanson.
Morning.
Whenever you're ready, good morning.
Please the court. My name is Philip Nathanson. I represent the plaintiffs in this court. I would like to focus my presentation this morning on the issue of the breach of lease or breach of contract claim brought against the Potash corporate entities and rely on our various briefs to fill in the rest of our arguments. We contend in this court that the issue is as follows. Where a company sues for breach of a lease, a commercial office lease, and the state court dismisses the case for lack of standing, as occurred here because the land trustee, American National Bank, had transferred its land trust business to LaSalle, where the dismissal is for lack of standing, which is not an adjudication on the merits, that result on the breach of lease claim against the Potash corporate entities cannot be res judicata or collateral estoppel.
Doesn't Illinois law treat standing determination as a determination on the merits?
It does not, Your Honor. We cite the cases, especially the River Plaza case, and this very case in this very case, the appellate court in the corporate case against the Potash entities said as a matter of justiciability, having decided there was no standing, the court could not then go on and reach issues such as the assignment of rents issue, which had been reached in the lower court and which the appellate court did not want to reach. In fact, the River Plaza case, which is a 2009 Illinois appellate court case, said, once an Illinois court says there's no standing, that's it. Stop the music. The court doesn't have jurisdiction to pronounce on anything else.
Well, wasn't that River Plaza case overruled by the Supreme Court of Illinois' decision in LeBron?
We contend, Judge Williams, that it was not.
Because didn't that LeBron court specifically say that standing does not implicate subject matter jurisdiction?
The LeBron court said, as discussed below in its opinion, and that's a quote, as discussed below, it doesn't implicate the subject matter jurisdiction of the court because the first defendant never pled a standing affirmative defense, and the second defendant abandoned on appeal their affirmative defense on standing. So the court in LeBron, as we read the opinion, was saying, we don't have to sua sponte reach the issue of standing where we have two defendants, one has abandoned the defense, the other one never pled the defense. In Illinois, I can't contest it, standing is an affirmative defense in Illinois. It is not, as in this case, in this building, in a federal claim, part of the plaintiff's case to show that they're standing. If the defendant doesn't raise the affirmative defense of standing, it's abandoned and the court doesn't have to deal with it. But this case, the defendant did raise the affirmative defense of standing, and they prevailed on the affirmative defense of standing. So this isn't a forfeiture case where a defendant decides to just let the standing issue go and proceed to the merits of the case. LeBron is strictly a forfeiture case, and that is not negated, as far as the plaintiffs are concerned. That does not negate the River Plaza or other cases that say once standing has been litigated and the court has determined there is no standing, then we have to stop. That wasn't the issue presented in the LeBron case. And it's clear, we believe, Judge Williams, from the context of the discussion, that What LeBron was saying is we don't have to deal with it because the defendants chose not to deal with it. Now, that's on the level of subject matter jurisdiction. Whether or not there's subject matter jurisdiction after a standing ruling doesn't answer the second question we raise in this appeal, which is where multiple issues are litigated in the lower court, and the case goes up on appeal to the Illinois Appellate Court, as it did here, and the court affirms on one issue only, standing. Does that mean that all that is res judicata is the one issue that was reached by the appellate court? That really is a restatement of judgment section 27, comment O issue, not an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. Whether or not LeBron, as Judge Bucklow thought, negates the River Plaza and other cases on standing in the Illinois courts, assuming arguendo that the district court was correct on that, that still doesn't answer the second question, which is where the appellate court chooses to reach one of many issues briefed and presented to the court and affirms on that one issue, does that leave the circuit court judgments that were entered on the other issues alive for res judicata purposes? We have cited in our briefs multiple Illinois cases and cases in this building where district court judges follow the Illinois cases, which say that the circuit court judgments remain unadjudicated for res judicata purposes, where they were raised on appeal but not reached on appeal because the appellate court only decided one of many issues. It wouldn't matter if the one of many issues was standing or anything else. In this case, it turned out the one issue that was raised was standing. And it's clear from reading the appellate court's Rule 23 order that the court didn't want to reach and felt it should not reach any of the other issues after having already decided that there was no standing in a land trustee that had sold its land trust business. So that is what led us to refile this case in the district court here. We're asking this court to follow the rule in the restatement, section 27, that the issues that were not reached on appeal in the corporate lease case against Potash remain unadjudicated for purposes of res judicata. And it's pretty clear that the cases interpreting what controls when there's an affirmance on one issue rather than all the issues presented say that only the one issue is raised through judicata if there's any difference between the appellate and the circuit court adjudications. Here you have an appellate court that says we don't want to reach this assignment of rents issue in every mortgage in Illinois. We're just going to limit this to standing and affirm on the basis of standing. One of the issues that the district court raised, in addition to that which had been raised in the motion, was that a second case that had been filed, a fraud suit against individual corporate officers and directors, could also serve as a res judicata component in the analysis because the plaintiffs could have brought the corporate breach of lease case in this individual fraud suit. That is not the case under Illinois law, as we point out in our brief. I would like to point out that when the fraud suit was filed, it had already been 3 years since the corporate breach of lease case was on file. The response to the fraud suit was a motion to dismiss for prior action pending that was brought by the defense or an alternative request to consolidate the two cases. Following the hearing on that motion, the two cases were in fact consolidated, as the record shows. They were ordered to pend with one another. So there is no reason that one can imagine that the plaintiffs in this case, after suing Potash Inc. and the Potash corporate defendants for rent, having that case pending for 3 years, bringing an individual fraud case against individual corporate officers and defendants, having those two consolidated by the chief judge of the circuit court, would then turn around and file another breach of lease action against the potash corporate entities when that had been on file for 3 years and the case, that case was consolidated with the individual fraud case. If the court please, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bektoris.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ken Rectoris. I represent the appellees. I guess I'd like to respond in the order that the arguments were made by the appellant's counsel. First of all, on the issue, and I'm going to focus now just on the corporate action and not the individual action, I think it's important not to lose sight of the fact that the res judicata attaches to both the corporate action and the individual action, and that the issues that were raised below in the 4.5 pages that the plaintiff devoted to res judicata in response to our motion dismissed below were exclusively, their argument was exclusively directed to the corporate action and one component of res judicata. That's whether there was a ruling on the merits. I'm going to get to that now because that's what counsel focused. But my hesitation in starting this way is not to emphasize this because the district court below ruled that there was complete res judicata as a separate matter in the individual action, which has zero standing issues, and also ruled that there had been a waiver on all the arguments other than whether there was a ruling on the merits in the corporate action. So it's an intellectually interesting issue, I guess, but my point is that there's myriad grounds outside of this upon which the district court relied on.
Well, let me just, before you proceed, were all the cases consolidated?
No, they were not. You know, I did a timeline because this was 8 years of litigation. The corporate suit was filed in 2001 and assigned to Judge Goldberg. The individual suit was filed in 2004 and went to Judge McNamara. We filed a motion to dismiss. It was fully briefed. Judge McNamara sent it to Judge Goldberg to pend with. They were still two separate cases, up on two separate appeals. For a period of 1 year and 5 months, Judge Goldberg had both separate cases. Plaintiff then moved to recuse Judge Goldberg as being biased. The corporate case went to Judge Burke. The individual case, plaintiff moved for a change of venue from Judge Goldberg as being prejudicial counsel, went to Judge Winkler. Judge Winkler entered the motion or the dismissal with prejudice. Judge Goldberg had issued consequential damages in the corporate suit. Judge Dennis Burke entered
the initial dismissal, though, of the individual suit was without prejudice.
Yes. And then plaintiff did nothing for, it's in our brief, 2.5 years. And it was called up on a calendar call for status. And he dismissed it with prejudice. Plaintiffs went in, complained that Judge Goldberg was biased against them. He sent it out for an independent determination in front of Judge Winkler, who went through the whole file, issued an opinion saying, come to the same conclusion. You've done nothing. You still do nothing, because you stand here today in front of me, Judge Winkler, to try and reinstitute this suit. So they weren't consolidated. There was a year and a half where they pended with, but they were always two separate cases, went up on two separate appeals. The law, okay, on this narrow issue of whether or not the court ruled on affirmed on standing, does that mean that the Illinois courts have no subject matter jurisdiction and it effectually, quote, eviscerates, it's a district court's word, all the final judgments in the corporate action? LeBron is on point. It is the latest statement, the latest pronouncement on this issue by the Illinois Supreme Court. It does not say that this is a situation where standing wasn't raised. And rely on that as a grounds. It says specifically, Because issues of standing and ripeness do not implicate this court's subject matter jurisdiction, and it's the second part that plaintiff's counsel relied on, because the only party who raised these issues has abandoned them on review, we decline to address these issues. And then it goes on to say, and this was the famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, where they struck down the million-dollar cap on medical mal damages. The dissent in this case raised plaintiff's argument. He said, or the dissent said, you cannot adjudicate the constitutionality of the statute because the plaintiff doesn't have standing. And this court, the Supreme Court, said, yes, we can. It doesn't matter. We are not an Article III court. This is not Article III standing is not synonymous with subject matter jurisdiction. It's completely different. Standing is irrelevant to whether we can go forward on these other issues. And the First District, in two cases, which we've cited in our brief after LeBron, have held the same thing. They basically held that standing is not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. It's an affirmative defense that can be waived. Can't waive subject matter jurisdiction. Plaintiffs argued below in state court that we had waived standing. If it was jurisdictional, they wouldn't have done so. The second point that counsel made was, I view it as a collateral estoppel argument. They were saying that because, apart from jurisdiction, because the appellate court only passed on standing, it was not necessary to go to the fraud and the consequential damages. And, in fact, the Illinois appellate court left undisturbed the circuit court final judgments on fraud and on consequential damages. But that's not the law. If there was a reversal, and what counsel's arguing is that the appellate court opinion takes precedence over any circuit court opinions. Clearly, if there was a reversal, if the Seventh Circuit reversed the district court, that would take precedence. But here you have an affirmance on the standing ground. And the Baird-Warner case and all the cases, 22 Chestnut case we cite, is in the context of standing, holds that absent a reversal, absent a discrepancy, it's the circuit court final judgments that continue, carry the day. So what do we have here in the corporate case? We have a final judgment on the breach of contract in the context of consequential damages on the fraud. And in the individual action, we have a final judgment affirmed by the First District on the fraud. And those don't somehow, and this is what Judge Bucklow said, how could those things, it was affirmed, there was an affirmance. How can the circuit court judgments vanish into thin air because there was affirmance on standing? It makes no sense. The last argument that plaintiff raised, which is apart from all the standing analysis, is the individual action. And the plaintiff did not argue this below, and it's a separate lawsuit that was between American National, Harms Road, and Mr. Doyle, CEO of Potash, and Mr. Hampton, General Counsel of Potash, identical fraud claim, identical to the corporate suit. And plaintiff argued in its briefs, well, we couldn't file. How could we file a breach of contract case against the individuals? That's not what the district court said, and that's not the point for res judicata. Res judicata means that you can't split your claims. A plaintiff comes to court, they have to bring all their claims in one lawsuit. They can't hold back claims, which is what plaintiff's arguing here. So if you lose on something, you can file a second suit and say, well, they're a little bit different. So they had an obligation, and they're the ones who chose to do it this way. They could have voluntarily dismissed one case and brought a different action. They could have substituted in the right party for standing. There's a whole bunch of things that could have been done throughout this case that they chose not to. They have to bear the consequences, and the consequences under res judicata is that all the issues relating to the same operative facts, which were alleged in both state court cases and in this federal case, which is a replica, it's a cookie-cutter replica, they're waived, they're binding. The judgments below not only apply to the fraud claim in the individual case, but any claim that could have been raised against the parties. It's the same claims, it's the same parties. Harms Road was a plaintiff in the individual case. Harms Road is a plaintiff in the federal case. Mark Goodman, the plaintiff in the federal case, is the principal of Harms Road. The defendants are the CEO and general counsel of Potash, the defendants in this case, who were alleged in the individual action to have acted on behalf of the corporation. and it's the same occurrence. You would not have a fraud claim in this case but for the contract. It's the contractual relationship which is at issue. The plaintiffs are essentially claiming an intentional breach of contract. The last issue, and counsel did not cover it, but it's an issue that's on appeal, and that's the fraud claim. This claim has been dismissed so many times. In the corporate action by Judge Burke, in the individual action by Judge Goldberg, and it was also found by the district court that it failed to state a claim. It's amazing to me that we have a claim on which the plaintiffs acknowledge in their papers that they were on notice of in December of 2000. That's when they allege, at the latest they were aware of it, when Potash sent a letter indicating the reasons for the early termination, that they could file that lawsuit in August of 2000. It's a 5-year statute of limitations, but they could file that lawsuit 10 years later in good faith. And it's time-barred, and for all the reasons that a number of jurists below in state court and in district court have ruled, it fails to state a claim. You see I have the light, so if there's any questions.
There are no additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does he have? 6 minutes. Mr. Nathanson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rectoris mentioned that we spent 4.5 pages of our response to the motion to dismiss below on res judicata. That is undoubtedly true, since more than half of the motion to dismiss was based upon an alleged assignment of the lease that destroyed diversity jurisdiction. Mr. Rectoris asked Judge Bucklow to dismiss the case for lack of diversity jurisdiction, claiming that the lease had been assigned to an Illinois potash entity which destroyed complete diversity. We spent, I believe, 10 or more pages of our response to the motion to dismiss dealing with the diversity issue first, which has been abandoned now that Mr. Rectoris prevailed on the merits on the res judicata point. Moving on to this issue of waiving subject matter jurisdiction, it is true that we argued that subject matter jurisdiction was waivable by defendant if they don't plead the affirmative defense of standing. Indeed, the defense first filed a standing affirmative defense to the fourth amended complaint. They had never pled standing as an affirmative defense prior to that. So when they filed the standing affirmative defense of the Fourth Amendment complaint and prevailed on it, we argued in the course of that it was waivable. What we have argued in this court, however, is this. Even though it's a defendant can waive standing by not pleading it, once they plead it and prevail on that defense, once they have won and convinced the court that the plaintiff didn't have standing, that result, separate and apart from whether standing is waivable up front as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, once they win on it, then the court cannot proceed any further to the merits of the case. The defense has no answer to the latter point. And while it is true, as Mr. Rectoris just told the court, that there have been a couple rulings on the merits of the common law fraud claim, there has never been a ruling on the merits of the breach of corporate lease, breach of contract claim against the two potash entities.
But if it could have been brought, then res judicata will preclude.
Well, our position
going forward with that claim.
Well, of course, that is the general rule, Judge Tinder, and I would certainly not quarrel with that. But our position before this court is this. It was already brought. It's not a matter of could have been brought. It was brought in 2001 as a corporate breach of lease case against the two potash entities. What the defense argued was it could have also been brought in the individual common law fraud case against two corporate officers and directors for common law fraud. Our position in our briefs here is this. First of all, individual corporate officers and directors are not liable for breach of a corporate lease where they sign the lease in their representative capacity. So it could not have been brought as a rent claim. It was brought as a fraud claim. It could not have been brought as a rent claim against two individual officers and directors. And insofar as whether you would plead another breach of corporate lease in the individual case after having already pleaded it in the first case in 2001, and the case was still pending, and Mr. Rectoris told the court, I apologize for having to switch glasses so many times, that there, when asked by the court whether they were consolidated, defense counsel has argued throughout this case, and I quote, Doyle's motion to dismiss included an alternative request, if the motion to dismiss was denied, that the individual suit be consolidated with the corporate suit. The defense, when we filed the individual suit for fraud against the corporate officers and directors, asked to consolidate the two cases in a motion to dismiss for prior action pending. As Mr. Rectoris told all the Illinois courts, Judge McNamara entered a transfer order, and Judge Maddox, the chief judge, reassigned the individual suit to Judge Goldberg to pend with the related corporate suit. They were pending together. They were consolidated by the chief judge. So I have never understood why you would then turn around and replead the corporate breach of lease case against two corporate parties in the individual case when the individual case was consolidated to pen with, and even after they were decoupled, after the consolidation, for reasons which, whoop, my time's up. I thank the court
well,
for.
When the red light, you got one more minute.
Okay. Even after they were decoupled and they weren't pending together anymore, the fact is that Judge Burke entered summary judgment and we appealed in the corporate breach of lease case. That case was in fact brought. And the final point I want to make is this. If it was when the defense moved to dismiss for prior action pending, when we brought an individual common law fraud claim and said you couldn't bring an individual common law fraud claim because there was already a fraud claim pending against the corporation. If that's prior action pending, then so would have a new breach of lease case brought in another case. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. We'll take the case under advisement. And